Hi, my name is Robin Shelby. You probably remember me as Slimer from Ghostbusters 2 and Lady Slimer from 2016's Ghostbusters Answer the Call. And you're listening to Rants from the Black Lodge podcast.
Recording live from the Black Lodge, it's me, the free will burning, head turning, ass kicking, machismo dripping, master podcasting, mouthpiece of the Southeast, Brandon A. Lane, bringing you a new edition of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast, but not just any edition, the 1 year anniversary edition. Man, if you were to tell me, or have told me a year ago, that we'd be trotting along a year in, still going strong and gaining an audience, then man, I don't know what I would have thought. To be honest with you, we got to the second episode and I was like, fuck this. So we're still trotting along and I didn't get here on my own. So I am very, very grateful for everybody that's pitched in. But I gotta tell you a little headache of how this 1 year anniversary has played out so far. So it took three attempts to get the commentary. First time, it was me, Fat Fuck Scott, and Cameron, who unfortunately this would have been his final appearance on the podcast, and it just never ended up becoming that way. We popped my Blu-ray copy in, it got to the courtroom scene, and it completely shit the bed, started skipping, so we scrapped it, and we started again, and you know, I think, you know, resetting and stuff, it was the disheartenment, and we just didn't have the same fire. So I listened back to the episode, and man, like, all the research I did, like, it wasn't up to snuff. So I ended up having to record the episode again by myself. Yet again, sort of an interesting, we've been doing this show so long now that this is only the third time I've gone a podcast on my own. And oddly enough, though, the first episode was Ghostbusters, and now I'm doing Ghostbusters 2 on my own. But man, if I knew anything and know anything, it's Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2. So I hope you're not too disheartened, and I am sorry to Scott and Cameron for your efforts. You know, Cameron, good luck out there in Seattle, and maybe someday you'll come back. We'll get you back on the podcast. And Scott, fuck you. You got plenty of opportunities to be on the podcast. You'll be back again. We got a Christmas coming up in December, so we'll get you back. New listeners to the podcast, welcome aboard. I hope you like what you hear. As always, you can find us on Twitter. Follow us there at Rants Black Lodge. You can visit us at our homepage at juicykruger.com. If you're not familiar with what a Juicy Kruger is, go back in our archive and listen to our Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3 episode, which was definitely in the contention for episode of the year. We had a little poll in the Facebook group, and the top three, oddly enough, and this kind of surprised me, number three, Leprechaun. The download count doesn't exactly show that it was a popular episode, but those of you who downloaded it, you really did like it. Number two, it was Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3. That was the birth of Juicy Kruger, and shout out to Judd Kelly, big part of the success of the show. He was on that episode, and he brought the funny on that one. Didn't do it so much in the Frankenhooker episode, piece of shit. I'm just joking. But coming in at number one, our most recent episode, and definitely the most well-researched episode in the history of the podcast, and Adam Marcus approved, was Jason Goes to Hell. Man, it was very, very, very surprising, the outpouring, the support everybody's given for it. Everybody seemed to really enjoy it. I've yet to hear back from Adam, but he's a busy guy. I'm going to give him a little buffer, and then Adam, I'm coming for you, bro. I'm going to make you comment on it. But if you want to listen to these episodes, go back in our archive and help us out. Still ranked number one as far as download count is our Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park episode. And ranking in at number two as far as downloads is Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. So, Scott and Eddie, you guys are kind of neck and neck with, you know, popularity. So maybe you you settle your differences in the squared circle. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. And rounding out our number three as far as downloads go, another Eddie episode. Actually, Eddie's second appearance on the podcast with No Holds Barred. I'm very grateful to everybody that's been a part of this podcast, and I want to give a specific shout out to the young lady who you heard at the top of the podcast, Miss Robin Shelby. Robin is such a sweetheart. I can't stress the fact enough that she didn't have to do this. I know her through the Smoky Mountain Ghostbusters. She's really great with fan groups, and I want to give her a little shout out. She's doing a web series. Actually, it's a Facebook series, but it may be on YouTube as well. It's called Two Cops in a Car. At the time of this recording, she's only released one episode. And I have to say, like, I didn't really know what I was going to be getting in for, but I genuinely laughed. So I think if you want something, just a good little time waster, you know, brighten your day, go check it out. You can go to Facebook. It's at Two Cars and a Cop. Or actually, that may be their Twitter. Anyways, if you type two, as in the number, cops and a car, you can find them on Facebook. Robin, thank you again. Find her on Twitter. Give her a shout out. Let her know how appreciative you are. So without further ado, this podcast is available on a multitude of platforms, Spotify, Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, and Google Play Music. So go listen to our other episodes and spread the word like wildfire. And we'll be back after these following messages from our sponsors for a running commentary from the 1989 supernatural comedy classic Ghostbusters 2. Stay tuned.
October 12th and the 14th at the Meadowview Convention Center, it's Conapalooza. What is Conapalooza? Conapalooza is a pop culture and gaming convention located in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains in beautiful Kingsport, Tennessee. Our goal is to bring something new to the Tri-Cities area. We want to bring together comics, cosplay, gaming, horror, anime, kids programming, contests, and even after 9 p.m., 18-plus adult-only programming, and much, much more. We will have dozens of stars on hand for fan meetups, meet-and-greets, and autograph sessions. Dozens of vendors offering the latest and greatest of past and present pop culture goodies, anime awesomeness, and sci-fi swag. Come see amazing fan groups like the Smoky Mountain Ghostbusters, the Mandalorian Mercs, the 501st Legion, and more. That's Conapalooza, October 12th through the 14th at the Kingsport Meadowview Convention Center. Be there.
Next Generation Wrestling brings some of the most talked about and star-studded professional wrestlers from around the world. Based out of East Tennessee, NGW is becoming one of the most sought-after independent wrestling promotions in the past 4 years. Witness NGW Live or on demand on the High Spots Wrestling Network streaming app. Follow us on social media platforms at NextGenTN.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to our one-year anniversary extravaganza with a running commentary for the 1989 Ghostbusters sequel. Yeah, that's right, Ghostbusters 2. If you're new to the podcast and you want to listen along, what we're going to do is I'm going to have you, to avoid all the piracy warnings and all that nonsense that usually causes the podcast to get out of whack, out of sync and such. If you do want to watch along, go to the... we're watching from the 2005 double feature gift set, Ghostbusters 1 and 2. Obviously, you'll pop in the second disc. I'm going to have you go to the scene selection, and you'll be clicking on scene 1. And what we'll do is I'll do a little countdown, 3, 2, 1. When I say hit play, and
you can listen along, or if you just want to hear me ramble and throw out a bunch of nonsense about a nearly 30-year-old movie, then by all means, do so. Either way, I'm glad to be here, and hopefully you like what you hear. All right, for those of you watching along, on the count of three, two, one, play. Right off the bat, I gotta say it's nostalgic to see the Columbia Pictures logo. Now, you know, Sony owns Columbia Pictures, so with the 2016 movie, seeing the Sony opening just doesn't have the same feeling. Speaking of openings, this 5 years later graphic is kind of interesting little tale. The movie opens differently than a lot of theatrically released films in that it doesn't have any opening credits. I don't know if it's SAG, Screen Actors Guild, or the Writers Guild. You have to give people credit, so which is a mandate. Rightfully so, you want to know who worked on the movie. But they have to get special permission to be able to do this. So I'm not exactly sure why the reasoning is for that, but oh well. One of the other movies I can think of that had the same situation was Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which was very purposeful in not having any opening credits to give it sort of like a movie within a movie sort of scenario. But this is a completely different situation, so I'm not exactly sure why this movie ends up being like that. And that one, you know, vice versa, whatever. Okay, a little backstory on this film. Released June 16th, 1989. It had a budget of $37 million, which for the time was a pretty hefty budget. But it grossed $215 million, almost $216 million by the notes, the extensive amount of notes I've taken. But when you take into consideration what it made on home box office receipts and home video rather, and DVD digital over the years, I mean, this movie has made a lot of money. On top of the fact that it's a holiday staple around New Year's, this movie has always played and really played all year round. TBS, TNT, USA, you name it, this movie is shown pretty constantly. I have to say, growing up, you know, I was born in 84, same year as the movie. It came out, you know, 3 weeks after I was born. All-time favorite film. And I wouldn't put Ghostbusters 2 necessarily in my... It's definitely not in my top 10, probably not in my top 20. But if I had to break it down and contextualize and itemize my favorite films of all time, it's certainly in the contention. I think it's a movie that, like fine wine, has gotten better with time. Seeing that that rusted out Ectomobile go down the road, kind of cool. I work at a haunted house in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and right under us, there is a place called Star Cars. They have, you know, cars from the movies and you know, kit from Knight Rider and all that, and they have an Ectomobile, and they claim the car that they have is from the first movie. I don't believe that to be true at all. For one, it has a 1989 license plate on it, so I've often wondered if the car that they have in there is actually the car from the beginning of this movie. Either or, George Barris made that car. Legendary designer, he did the Batmobile, and from 66 Batman show, not the 89. This kid right here, that is Ivan Reitman's son. He has had quite the career for himself in film, both as an actor and as a four-time Academy Award nominated director. His name is Jason Reitman. He's done a lot. We'll get to his acting career. He was in a lot of his dad's films. Obviously, Ivan Reitman, the director of this film, knowing he can rely on the benefit of his kids to fill in some of those awkward kid scenes. But he was in Twins and Kindergarten Cop, and anybody my age, we love those movies. I don't know that I could actually pick him out of those movies if I went back and watched. Kind of makes me want to go back and do so to see if I could pick him out. The only thing I think of off the top of my head with Kindergarten Cop is Miko Hughes, and another roundabout reference to Wes Craven's A New Nightmare. He plays Nancy's, what is her, Heather Langenkamp, because she's playing herself, plays Heather Langenkamp's son. He was also Gage in Pet Sematary, but in Kindergarten Cop, he has that awesome line, "Boys have a penis, girls have a vagina." It's just very, very politically incorrect, I guess you could say, these days. But you gotta love the movie and those early comedies from Ivan Reitman. Ivan Reitman was on the roll of a lifetime, you know, with so many movies that we hold dear. You know, this time was sort of like the golden age of comedy, and not just in directing, but I mean, like, he produced so many things too. But obviously, he directed Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters 2, Kindergarten Cop, Twins, Meatballs, Stripes. By the way, Meatballs, 100% the reason I wanted to go to camp as a kid. And then you got my my number two favorite movie, Friday the 13th, is definitely the reason why I did not want to go back. The illusions that we're having right here in this scene, kind of foreshadowing events that will come to pass later in the film. Actually, the beginning of the movie, where you have Dana walking down the street and everybody's treating each other like shit. Well, Egon makes reference to the fact that he and Ray had some ideas back when they were "quote unquote" Ghostbusters, to how positively and negatively emotions could influence somebody, and the whole MacGuffin of the story being that there's a, you know, slime under the street that's sort of fueling this hatred. The little girl, Egon is filming right there. That is Ivan Reitman's daughter, so it's definitely a family affair. You may have noticed her. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. She has a continuous role in that show. Her name is Catherine Reitman. She's actually done quite a bit as well, acting wise. Which is just cool, because being in the shadow of someone famous can be kind of a positive and a detriment. But, I mean, she, obviously, like her brother, she was in Twins, she was in Kindergarten Cop. She was in Knocked Up with Harold Ramis, so there's another kind of weird turnaround and connection, one of those 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of scenarios. There's a show called Blackish. I believe it's on ABC. She's on that show. She's done 19 episodes. And there's a show called Working Moms, or Working Moms, you know, no G. She did 26 episodes of that. I'm not really familiar with those shows, but she was on them. Here we have Dr. Peter Venkman and his World of the Psychic show. As a kid, this was always my favorite scene. I just always wanted more Peter being snarky. To his left, we have playing Milton Englund. That's Kevin Dunn. He's a character actor. He's been tons of things. Fairly recently, you probably noticed him from the Transformers movies. He plays Sam Witwicky's dad. I would argue that the first movie, while not a masterpiece, is actually fairly decent, and a lot of that hangs on Sam's interaction with his parents. There's this one great scene where his parents are kind of questioning Sam, like, what's going on, and he's sort of trying to divert their attention, because outside on his lawn, you know, you've got Optimus Prime and Bumblebee, and I just thought that was sort of a great comedic moment, and Milt, or Kevin, rather, plays that to the hilt. He, in more serious roles, he was in Mississippi Burning, which is a terrific movie. You gotta love Gene Hackman. He was in Nixon. But he's not susceptible to being in a turd from here and for here or there. He was in the 1998 Godzilla. Ouch! But not only, like, he double-dipped, he was in 20 episodes of its cartoon, which I didn't even know existed, but evidently it was popular enough with stupid kids that it got a television show. Now, God, I'm blanking on this actress's name, but, I mean, she was in tons of things in the 80s. And just like Back to the Future 2, where you have a character or a time being referenced that when came and passed was sort of a big deal. This character right here, she mentions February 14th, 2016, where the end of the world supposedly is going to occur. Man, Facebook was a joy that day. It's like everybody was posting, you know, Valentine's Day, bummer, memes and all of that. I got a big kick out of that. I love Peter's reactions from when she's, what she's saying here. God, he's just so believable as an asshole, which is sort of like the rap on Bill Murray, is that, like, he's super nice, he's good to people, like, he's friends with, but he's also, like, just such a snarky prick. And, man, I can appreciate that, because I, you know, consciously or subconsciously, I think I have, that gene in me, where, I may not always mean it to be, you know, be taken as a snarky asshole, but that Bill Murray disease I have runs pretty rampant. Hairless cats. Weird. Several years ago, they had these Minimates figures for Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2, and when they released these two packs, one of them had World of the Psychic Peter, and he comes with a tiny hairless cat, which is just such a nice little touch for any collector. I don't have that entire set, but that was one of them I specifically sought out. I actually had to buy it on eBay for an increased price because I couldn't find it, because Toys R Us was far away. And oh, we have Kurt Fuller here playing Jack Hardemeyer. Kurt Fuller, man, he's had a career as well. For longtime listeners of this podcast, you'll know that Stank Dick Eddie, shout out, he and I, and I guess it was the second episode that he and I did together, we did No Holds Barred. He plays Brill in that film, the antagonist to Rip, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan, or Hulk Hogan, a.k.a. Rip. But he's been in tons of things as well. The Running Man, Red Heat, both with Schwarzenegger, which is another weird kind of contextual thing you put together, because Schwarzenegger worked with Ivan Reitman quite a bit, but he was in Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Ow! Love them boobies. Wayne's World, and more contemporarily, a lot of people probably know him from Psych. He was in 33 episodes of that. Oh, and here we have the terrific, terrific Peter McNichol playing Janosz Pocha. Janosz's character was designed on paper to be, I guess, more two-dimensional, and he really brings this character to life. I believe, from what I've read, it was his input that they make him, you know, Carpathian and have the accent, and that would make more of a correlation between him and the Vigo painting, rather than it's just some guy who gets possessed by it. He's like a receptacle for Vigo's will, because of, you know, maybe a similar bloodline or, you know, whatever. I would love to talk to Peter McNichol about his choices, because in many ways he takes the Lewis role in this film, which is both good and bad, because Lewis Tully is one of the highlights of the first film, and a lot of his subplot, we'll get into a little later, is cut out of the film, so he doesn't have as much to do. There's some early use of CGI, and for 1989, that's not too bad. You know, obviously, this is before Jurassic Park and Terminator 2 kind of redefined the book or the wheel. This gentleman who just purchased some stuff from Ray, who says, "My best to the coven." That character right there, there's a fan film that came out, I believe, in the past year or so, called Ghostbuster Station 6, and they have completely spun that character off into his own lineage and bringing everything back with Oscar Barrett, Dana's son, and Ghostbusters 2 and Vigo, which is kind of cool. Now, we have this whole cinematic universe, much like, you know, there's the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where we have the Ghostbuster fan film cinematic universe, where they're keeping the original continuity alive. Initially, there was a scene shot, or actually, I don't know if it was shot, or it was definitely in the script, where Peter was continually prank calling Ray at his bookstore, and unfortunately, that didn't make it into the film. But when he comes in asking for his book, he was asking, you know, calling and prank calling about that, and that probably would have added a lot to the scene. But God, time, running time, people, people want things a little more straight and narrow when it comes to the flow of a film. So we got it the way it is. As a kid, the scene where he grabs Peter's ears, I had a cousin, and I would meticulously do this to him, you know, out of abusive comedy, mostly for myself. I love that Peter gets, he gets a serious look on his face when it comes to Dana. And we have Dana still keeping herself in line with her musical background, having the kid, you know, it sort of derailed her career. And there's sort of allusions that the father of Oscar, depending on which direction you want to take it, at least on paper, would have been the musician from the first movie, who, when Peter meets Dana and they're out, you know, the fountain, the classic spinning in the orange jacket scene. The musician from that show, who, you know, has the nose spray, that very well may be Oscar's father. But I know at one point when they were, you know, the many times that they were going to do Ghostbusters 3 and the many script rewrites that it went through, that it was actually going to be the revelation that Oscar was Peter's son. And perhaps there would be some elements of, well, let's make up for lost time, bonding, that kind of stuff. I've often wondered if this this scene with Peter plucking on the cello, if that was in the script or if that was him him improvising. Obviously, his exploits of improvising was legendary on the first film, going so far that many people think he should have been given a writing credit because of how much improv he did. I'm not sure how much improv was done on this movie. I know that they had a lot less time on the acting side of things because, and one of the many reasons why, I guess there's a lot of directions you could take why Bill Murray dislikes this movie, but one of the things that he's continually said across the board, his dislike of this movie, was that the special effects team kind of took it over. And they had to dedicate so much time to the special effects, which admittedly are terrific, and they really do hold up, with one or two exceptions. Which even the first movie, I think the special effects hold up. But then you get to the part where the terror dog is running out of the out of the building, and it's pretty bad. But this movie's special effects hold up pretty well. Speaking of special effects, we have a changeover in teams from the people who worked on the first film. The first was Boss Films, and they if I'm remembering this correctly, and if I'm not, please someone correct me. I believe that that they broke off from ILM, and like these people, they worked on Star Wars and a lot of those films, but they wanted to break off and do their own thing. And here it is. All right. But it was Richard Edlund who did the special effects in the first movie, and with Boss Films, and Dennis Muren and ILM took over for this film, and the quality is comparable. I mean, 5 years difference in movie terms is pretty substantial. I mean, the advancements, especially when you take into consideration that big budget special effects really started in like 76, 77 with Star Wars. And as far as like, you know, shot composition and the way that they could edit things together, cobble them together. But 200 effect shots in this film, and the budget of the movie is on screen, and you can't deny that they skimped on anything. Which is another interesting fact, that a lot of these actors agreed to do the movie not for free, but a lot of them worked or at scale or at a near scale payment because they had so much fun working on the first movie. And to be quite honest with you, a lot of them didn't want to do the movie because they waited too long. Ghostbusters, as a world-building idea, has legs, and the cartoon, the animated series, does a lot to bring that to the forefront. But I think when they were conceptualizing this, once they defeat Gozer, you know, the gate is closed, and you know there's not enough ghost in New York now to substantiate having a business. But the fans demanded it. And I can look back on this movie and have a conflicting ideology. I love this movie so much, but not having that third film makes me feel incomplete. Whereas, if we hadn't had a second film, I don't think I would have ever had this, like, oh my god, why isn't there a Ghostbusters sequel? But, I mean, that's the cut and dry kind of nature of what film and fandom, you know, it's a very fickle relationship. You want things, but you want them to be different. You want things, but you want them to be the same. A lot of the complaints people have about this film is that it's too similar to the first movie, and parallel wise, I completely agree with that. I love everything from the beginning to the courtroom scene because it has its own flavor. Now you can, I guess, draw parallels that it's, you know, kind of them opening the business, but things play out differently. You get more of an idea of like where everybody is, who's doing what. I kind of have some problems with this particular scene because there's no Winston, which I guess you could argue that they're approaching this from a more of a scientific point of view. Like, let's figure out what's going on down there. And Winston, who's still affiliated with him, obviously he's already been in the movie with Ray doing the birthday gig. But I think he should have been there. We have a lot of things that were cut out of this movie, and it's a shame because when you get all these special editions, DVDs and Blu-rays over the years, you get these deleted scenes. And between both movies, we're still missing scenes that were shot and never put back in. But this movie has things that are completely lost to time, or at least on the table right now. But things that were in the theatrical cut that have never been released on home video. And I'll point those out as we come, because I want to pay a little bit of attention to our antagonist of the film, Viggo, the Sorrow of Moldavia. He was conceptualized as to be kind of a Vlad Tempish, oh crap, I'm blanking on his name. Rasputin, sort of a Rasputin cloaked figure. And, you know, over time, things kind of evolved, and he became what we have now. But as interesting as the character is, because I'll be upfront, I think Viggo is a better villain in the traditional sense than Gozer was. But the film Ghostbusters 1 is such an unconventional movie in the way its narrative is structured that it's almost less important about the villain. It was them achieving their goals comedically, and kind of in a sense putting themselves out of business. The very thing that gave them business, they put themselves out of business. But I'm getting off track. Viggo is played by two people. Uncreditedly for so long, but finally we, you know, now know that Max von Sydow was the voice of Viggo. And it wasn't until the 2009 video game, which sort of serves as the third part of the trilogy of stories in the Ghostbusters original universe. when he reprised his role, you know, he'd go up to talk to the Vigo painting that's hanging out in their firehouse, which is sort of interesting when you think about it. It's like, why is that there? I guess maybe they donated it. It's like, we don't want this creepy painting in our art gallery anymore. That's besides the point. Norbert Group, a.k.a. Wilhelm von Homburg, was back in the 50s and 60s, he was a professional wrestler, and he moved into boxing. He actually had a pretty successful career. 30 wins, 24 by knockout, 6 decisions, 11 losses. That's not too bad. And he was a badass in and outside of the ring, where the character of Vigo may be lauded and loved, the man behind the character, not so much. Lots of stories about him just being really nasty, and being from that wrestling world, sometimes you hear these stories like, well, he was just working. That's inside slang for he was, you know, playing the role of bad guy. But then again, he was doing this stuff when he was boxing too. And I mean, boxing is you could argue that maybe boxing is fixed sometimes, but definitely him burning people with cigars and being a complete prick to people, that's not working. That's just you being an asshole. Once he retired from boxing and wrestling, he moved into the film world, and he, character actor, mainly like goons and background guys, but the movies he was in are definitely ones that stick out. Obviously, Ghostbusters 2, which we're watching right now. Die Hard, one of the terrorist goons, not the main one, but you can definitely see him in there a few times. And I don't know if he has any lines. I saw Die Hard in the theater actually, like December of last year, and I'm blanking if he had any actual lines. He was in Silence of the Hams, which the only reason I'm bringing that up because not a lot of people know about this movie, but it was a Dom DeLuise spoof movie on Silence of the Lambs. I highly recommend it if you can track it down. I actually don't own a copy of it. I used to have it on VHS, but I'm not sure if it's released officially on DVD or Blu-ray. I need to track that down. My favorite role, aside from GB2 that Wilhelm von Homburg appeared in, was in The Mouth of Madness. I'm a big John Carpenter fan, and you know, he plays this there's this town, and it's a very grieving situation, and I think he actually gets to do some decent acting in there. I'll get back to some Vigo facts a little later, because I want to talk about Harris Yulin. Actually, you know what? No, before I get down to Harris Yulin, the bailiff right there, who doesn't even have any lines, that is George P. Wilbur. George P. Wilbur, on paper, has had one of the most incredible careers of all time. Before I give his actual acting roles, I'm going to tell you the stunts he's done for. Star Trek II, Poltergeist, Beastmaster, Ghostbusters 1, Reanimator, Die Hard, Total Recall, Casino, Spider-Man, Rush Hour, Silence of the Lambs, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, Monster Squad, Escape from New York, Blazing Saddles, which is Fat Fuck Scott, shout out bitch, that's his favorite movie, High Plains Drifter, Blackula, Planet of the Apes, which is in my top 10. He acted in Cobb, great baseball movie based off Ty Cobb's life, with Tommy Lee Jones. He was in Loose Cannons with Dan Aykroyd, so there's your nice full circle, 6 degrees of separation again. He was in a couple of Schwarzenegger movies, another tied Ivan Reitman, not that he directed either one of these, Raw Deal and Running Man. He was in Firestarter, but a lot of people will know him from, I guess, what has become his signature role. Now, last episode, when we did Jason Goes to Hell, I pointed out the fact that that Nick Castle had directed Major Payne, the Wayans movie. And we all love that movie, ironically, to a degree. Not a great movie, but it's one of those that has a nostalgic place in all our lives. But it was just a cool, like, weird thing that, like, the original guy who played Michael Myers did all these things. Well, here's your second Michael Myers connection. Michael Myers, from 4 and 6, was played by George P. Wilbur. He's the only a handful of actors to play Michael Myers on multiple occasions, being that now Nick Castle has come back from the original and is doing the Halloween movie that will be coming out this year, also called Halloween, which is a stupid name. It's actually the third movie called Halloween, which brings me to the second movie called Halloween, which was Rob Zombie's Halloween, and Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. You have the gentleman, God, whose name's escaping me. Tyler Mane. So he's the only guy that played Michael Myers on multiple occasions. Halloween 4 is pretty loved. Halloween 6, not so much. I have a soft spot for it. The producer's cut, obviously. Not the theatrical. That bullshit. Let's talk about Harris Yulin. Yeah, he's been in a bunch of stuff. Playing Judge Wexler. Alright, full circle again. He was in Multiplicity, which was directed by Harold Ramis. So that's a cool reconnection. He was in 9 episodes of 24, very popular show. He was in Rush Hour 2, Training Day, great fucking movie. Clear and Present Danger, another great movie. And one of my all-time least favorite movies by one of my all-time favorite directors, Scarface. I fucking hate Scarface. Not a fan. This scene is edited to shit in the American version, where Peter gets the great line. Sometimes shit happens, somebody's got to deal with it, so who are you going to call? But this, the movies, but this scene in particular led me down a rabbit hole in doing research for this movie, and I'm going to butcher this name, but there is a very famous court case called Stambolivsky, Stambovsky versus Atchley. And it's from 91. It's commonly known as the Ghostbusters ruling. And it's a case in New York Supreme Court appellate division that held that a house, which the owner had previously advertised to the public as haunted by ghosts, was legally, for legal purposes, was deemed haunted for the purpose of action and rescission brought by a subsequent purchaser of the house. Because of its unique holding, the case has been frequently printed in textbooks on contracts and property law, widely taught in U.S. law school classes, and is often cited by other courts. So, Ghostbusters, you know, obviously the most famous supernatural comedy of all time, and here we have this courtroom scene, and I know a lot about Ghostbusters, and I didn't, you know, as the previous movies, I didn't need to do as much background or digging research that I would for, you know, say, a movie that, like, I love, but I don't know, like, the back of my hand, but finding that out was really cool. I have a friend, shout out Katie, who is a, who actually graduated from law school, so I'm looking forward to asking her about if she knows about this, because that's such a wild thing. Our court system is strange. But let's not rest on the courtroom aesthetic and get back into the courtroom scenes in the movie. We have the Scaleri brothers, which I absolutely love. Their design was modeled off of, sort of loosely, to Jake and Elwood Blues. Obviously, the Blues Brothers, which is in my top 10 favorite movies. Infinitely quotable. And, remark real quick. The shot of one of the Scaleri brothers carrying the prosecuting attorney out the door. In the trailer for the film, that scene has no special effects. It's just a woman being upside down, being drugged through the door, because they were literally working on these special effects down to the wire, with a big reason being is that the movie was supposed to come out, I believe, July 21st, and there was a little movie that came out. You may have heard of it. Broke box office records, grossed the most of any movie in 1989, a little film called Batman. Let me tell you a little story. The two greatest weeks of my childhood was July 16th, 1989, and July 21st, 1989. Seeing Ghostbusters 2 and seeing Batman in the theater was mind-blowing. Now, back in that time, I didn't get to go to the movies, like, in the theater very often. And, I mean, I don't want to drudge up a bunch of, like, negative, like, boo-hoo family sob stories, but my father, my biological father, was supposed to take me to see Ghostbusters. And, of course, he didn't show up. My grandfather ended up taking me. And that's just one of those great memories I had. And we saw the trailer for Batman. And I think he felt bad about my situation. And he was like, you know what? We're going to come and see this movie again. Now, where my grandfather lived is a place, it's a little hellhole in the middle of nowhere called Treadway. It's across Clinch Mountain. So it's, you know, like an hour drive to where, like, the closest movies was. It was a bit much for them to do this, but it's nostalgic, and it makes me feel good to this day. Like, I have such positive feelings about that time, and he was taken away from us way too soon. I love you. I love you, Paul. He passed away when I was in sixth grade. But he was a great guy. The summer, or God, really, the year 1989, when I think about great years in movies, it doesn't immediately come to mind, but fuck, man, it is. When I went back and looked at what all came out that year, it's up there, one of the greatest years ever in film going. So, like I said, Batman was number one at the box office. Number two, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Great movie. Number three was Lethal Weapon 2. Also a great movie, directed by Dick Donner. Love that guy. Made a lot of great films. Depending on what list you go for, Ghostbusters with either seventh or eighth. Still pretty good. Pretty good for overall. But let's talk about all the other movies, the blockbusters that came out this year, and cult films. I mean, the whole gamut of films that are memorable this year is just outstanding. Back to the Future Part 2, The Little Mermaid, Christmas Vacation, which for anybody that has a television around Christmas time knows that movie gets traction. It's not quite on the level of, what is the Ralphie movie? Christmas Story, but yeah, I'd probably put up there number two, like, as far as Christmas movies you're going to see. Well, maybe It's a Wonderful Life. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, another breakout role for Rick Moranis. Loved that movie growing up. Haven't seen it in quite a while. I need to track that down. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, fucking love it, great movie. As do I love the next movie on the list, Major League. I've said this before, I'll say it again. Any movie that has Corbin Burnson in it with Tom Berenger gets so much respect. Field of Dreams, if you're a baseball fan, obviously that's one of the seminal baseball movies of all time. Dead Poets Society, great movie. Karate Kid Part 3, not a great movie, but I still have nostalgic feelings towards it. Terry Silver, one of the greatest screen villains of all time. God, that guy hams it up. Hams it up so good. Friday the 13th, Part 8. Got a soft spot for that one. We'll definitely be doing it on the podcast eventually. Nightmare on Elm Street 5, which I believe is the Dream Master. We'll definitely be doing that on the podcast as well down the line. See No Evil, Hear No Evil. I've stated this a lot in the past, and a lot of people would imagine that if I had the ability to meet any celebrity living or dead, that it would be Bill Murray. Well, Bill Murray's number two on the list. Number one, Gene Wilder. I love Gene Wilder so much, and the world has suffered the greatest loss with his passing. We miss him. He left a legacy that is unparalleled. One of the funniest human beings ever. But he's one of those guys like Tom Hanks or Robin Williams that he just brought so much joy to people. Like, you can't help but look at him and smile. He just had a quality about him. And those Mel Brooks movies that he appeared in, all-time greats. Man, Young Frankenstein, one of the funniest performances ever. He's just his freakouts, best freakouts ever on screen. But he had that string of movies with Richard Pryor, and in a lot of ways, they're all kind of the same. But their chemistry is so good that, like, how do you not acknowledge the greatness that those two had? See No Evil, Hear No Evil. One of my favorite movies growing up. I watched it maybe a year ago. It still holds up. And knowing now what we know about Kevin Spacey, seeing him in that movie probably didn't hold the same weight that it would have if I had seen that, maybe a year before all this nasty bullshit came out. All right, back to the list. Roadhouse. I know a lot of people are a fan of that movie. The constant barrage of requests we get to do Point Break, and the Swayze train keeps a rolling, and everybody wants to hear what I got to say. Roadhouse and Point Break, both possibilities for the podcast, but I'm going to need a little bit more input from the fan base. So feel free to go on Twitter or Facebook group and let me know what you think about those ideas. Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, not a great movie, but another movie I watched to death as a kid. No Holds Barred, been on this podcast. There's your 1989, I guess, was a good year for Kurt Fuller. If you want to hear about that, go back in the archive and check that episode out. Definitely one of my favorites that we've done. Weekend at Bernie's. I love 80s movies, 80s comedies. They have a special place in my heart and my life, and that's one that will never be forgotten just because it's such a stupid premise. Like, we have a dead guy, let's puppet him and make everybody think he's alive. The James Bond movie, License to Kill, which was the second outing by Timothy Dalton. Ranks probably lowest on a lot of people's Bond list. I actually really like License to Kill, but it's sort of a precursor to the Bond movies we have now. Like, they grounded it more in reality, and Timothy Dalton took it as more of an acting role rather than, two-dimensional, which that's not my perception, but the most people's perception of James Bond being a two-dimensional character. It's hard to say who's the worst Bond. My favorite Bond is Roger Moore. Fight me on it. I will back up my reasons. Uncle Buck, When Harry Met Sally, The Original Puppet Master, Shocker, The Abyss, and Halloween 5. So, man, it makes me wonder if the reason that George Wilbur wasn't in Halloween 5 is because he had commitments working on this movie, because Don Shanks was Michael in that film. I will say definitively, as far as like the original continuity of the films, Don Shanks, you're my least favorite Michael. Sorry, I don't like this. I don't like your performance. But if you would give us a shout out and do an audio intro for when we do that episode, it'd be greatly appreciative. Don't draw this to his attention, anybody. Let's keep my opinion to myself. God, why did I say that? So stupid, so stupid. This movie had a tie-in with Hardee's. It was like 31,000 locations had this toy available. Well, I think there were like four variations. It's just a box that had a button on it. You press it and it made beeping noises. And there was a Ghostbusters sticker on it. They were available for like $1.79. But they were recalled because of a choking hazard. 2 million units ended up being recalled. Well, actually, shout out to Fat Tony. I believe he still has these. A few years ago, unfortunately, his father passed away. And I know at the time, prior to this that his dad still had those in a drawer somewhere. I had them. I actually had the Ghostbusters 2 vinyl banner from Hardee's. It said Ghostbusters 2 headquarters on it. For years, this hung in my grandmother's basement. And that was my my firehouse growing up. I had a box, and I had it cut to be a containment unit, and I had that banner. And she threw it away. She threw it away. I must say not long ago. It was maybe a year or two ago. On eBay, I saw one of those, and it sold for like $300 or $400. It just made me sick to my stomach, because the Black Lodge is covered in vinyl banners from my work. And, you know, every year we do a thing called Fright Nights. So I have all these previous Fright Nights banners just to cover space, because I have OCD and I like uniformity, and the white walls, they just pierce my eyes because I'm in the dark all the time. But I just think, like, my media room, right, the morgue, how awesome it would be to have that banner up there. I do, however, several years ago, I got a 1989... Subway poster from New York of Ghostbusters 2, and there's really not many of those left in the world. They were only available in New York subway stations, and it's a kind of, I don't know the exact dimensions of it, but the thing's huge. It's a quad poster. It's not the, you know, the like your vertical poster. It's more of a horizontal. You know, the length is in the width. Does that make sense? The width is in the width. What the fuck ever. If anybody wants to see it, I'll have Eddie, Stank Dick Eddie, send out a tweet about it or something. Sigourney Weaver has had such an interesting career. And in doing research for this episode, I came across her high school photo. She's so goofily adorable. I mean, being a 6 foot tall woman in high school, she was very striking, but she looks so sweet and nice. And to parlay from that into, I mean, arguably, you know, the greatest female action role of all time in Ellen Ripley, you know, Ridley Scott's 1979 opus of sci-fi horror, and then parlaying that into James Cameron's sequel, that's a pretty big leap. But, I mean, from all the movies that she's done, Grill in the Mist, and, oh my God, what is the movie where... oh my God, I own this movie and I'm blinking on what it's called, but she's like super neurotic, and, you know, besides the point, like, she's had a really varied career. Most recently, you know, she was on The Defenders. Definitely the most interesting story, or the aspect of that story, was her element, and I thought they killed her off just a little too quickly. The Joe Willie Namath jersey here, I'll give a little shout out to a grumpy New York Jets fan, a good friend of mine, a guy by the name of John Forsley. Forsley, I love you. I love Broadway Joe, but man, the fucking Jets. The Jets suck. So when this baby's wiping his ass on that Joe Namath jersey, that's kind of like what the Jets have been doing to themselves for, you know, however many years. Burn! I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. At least we make it to the playoffs from time to time. That may all change this season. I might want to keep my mouth shut about all that. This movie has, score-wise, is a little different from the first film. Randy Edelman, I believe that's how his name is pronounced, had worked with Ivan Reitman on Twins and Kindergarten Cop. And he was given the opportunity to do the score for this film because Elmer Bernstein, who did the score for the first movie, had to turn it down. Whether he turned it down because of commitments or he didn't want to do it, I'm not entirely sure. But he ended up working on My Left Foot with Daniel Day-Lewis around that same time. So, I would have loved to have had him do this movie, I think he made the right decision. The Ecto-Mobile, obviously, is an upgrade from the first movie. And, I would need to be paying attention, a little more attention to the film to point it out. But there's a part where it's quite obvious that at some point they changed the name of Ecto from Ecto 2 to Ecto 1A. Still not entirely sure why they did that, but there's a shot in the film where the plate says Ecto 2. I really hated Ecto 1A as a kid. There's something about being a kid where you thrive with like consistency and you want things to be the same and you don't want change. And now I look at Ghostbusters 2 and, man, I really appreciate the cosmetic differences. I love that they have the charcoal gray suits in some scenes. I love that the Ecto-1A has a bunch of ridiculous shit on top of the hood. The one thing I always did like was the caution striping, and I think every Ecto, you gotta have that caution stripe on there. It makes the contrast pop really good. I think this would be a good point to point out some of the things that were either shot for the movie and not put in, or were in the script and never shot. Ray is scanning the Vigo painting, and there's going to be a shot here in just a second where he's staring deeply into Vigo's eyes, almost longingly. And at the end of the film, Ray will be possessed, and I, Ray, am now Vigo, I rule the world, or whatever he says. But there's a part later on in the film, or at least there was supposed to be, where Ray, under the possession of Vigo, is driving erratically in the Ecto, and Winston has to punch him, and they wreck into a tree. I would have loved to have seen all of that, but it just never made it into the movie. And that's really sad. However, those things did end up in different versions of the movie. Which is, when I say different versions of the movie, I mean different media. There's The Real Ghostbusters, starring in Ghostbusters 2, which was a 3-issue comic released in, I believe, in 89. Or it may have came out in 90, but it was around the time of the release of the film. It's riddled with spelling and grammar errors. But overall, it's a pretty good adaptation. But it includes a lot of the subplots and things that were not in the movie. There's also two separate novelizations. One of them was written by Ed Naha. I believe that's how his name's pronounced. I own that version. And I've read it. It's not a terrific read, but I mean, it's not bad for a movie novelization. It's decent. But there's a version also released by Dell Publishing, who released the Ed Naha version by B.B. Hiller. And I don't know why there are two different novelizations. The only thing, because I haven't read the second one, the only difference I know offhand is that it has photos in it. So it makes me wonder if the Ed Naha version, well, they took the script and he adapted it to to the book, the novel, and perhaps the B.B. Hiller version was adapted directly from the movie. I'm not sure. If anybody knows about that, feel free to let us know, and we'll add that into the description of the video or something. Ghostbusters 2 is adapted for a lot of video game releases, some of which I have to this day anger problems about. There was some good versions I'll talk about first. There was New Ghostbusters 2. Which was released for the NES, but only in the PAL region, which is, like, Europe. It's the first time you could ever play as Winston or Lewis. Playing as Lewis, like, at all was sort of a novel thing, but the fact that Winston had never been available to play. Kind of shitty. You got to boil that down to racism. But there was an Amiga, a Commodore 64, DOS, ZX Spectrum, and I've never played any of these versions. I didn't have a computer until like the late 90s, and there was a Packard Bell piece of shit that I could barely get my 3D dinosaur game to play on. But in addition to the one of the worst NES games of all time, just the regular Ghostbusters, released by LJN, or as James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, would call them, Laughing, Joking, Numbnuts. They also released a sequel called Ghostbusters 2. In some ways, it's better than the first game. The first level, while albeit not great, you actually can do some stuff. But the downfall being is that I have never, ever made it past the second stage. The second stage is this, like, driving stage where you have, you're trying to avoid ghosts, and there's big, like, holes in the road, and you've got to drive over these boosters to make a car go fast, and I've never been able to do it. There's so many obstacles, and it isn't like that, you know, I'm devoid of hand-eye coordination. I mean, I'd like to say that I'm fairly decent at video games, but not this one. And I thought, like, for years, like, well, I was a kid. So when I'm maybe, like, 23 or 24, I still had an NES. I got it out of the attic, and I was at Rhino Video Games, which doesn't exist anymore. I found Ghostbusters 2. I bought it, and I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to make it past that second level. I'm going to beat this game. Well, after a good marathon of, like, 6 hours, I wanted to fucking punch the wall. Add insult to injury, you can't even pause the game. It doesn't have a pause setting on it. So even if you do manage to get past the second stage, what happens if you gotta take a crap? You're fucked. So I do not recommend Ghostbusters 2 for the NES at all. But if you can track down the PAL version, new Ghostbusters 2, highly recommend it. It's a top-down game. The video game style, I can't believe I'm comparing this, it actually kind of looks like Pokemon. I know that might make a lot of people happy. Me, not so much. Pokemon, a little past my generation, but that's what it looks like. Other media outlets, on the horizon and kind of branching off the playability, is we had coloring books and activity books by Honey Bear Books. There had to be some disconnect from them not having likeness rights to the characters because, wow, they made Egon in the coloring and activity books. He doesn't wear glasses. He actually kind of looks like a Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees. And Ray has like the most cringeworthy pedo stash. Like in the coloring book, you know, it sort of just beat by beat, page by page goes through the movie, and he and Winston are at the birthday party, and yeah. I wouldn't let that guy around my kids. Just saying. So I guess now would be a good time to get into some of these questions that you guys submitted. This comes from John Powell. Shout out to the Smoky Mountain Ghostbusters, which I am a member of. We do a lot of children's charities and stuff, and anybody that knows me knows that Ghostbusters is my jam, and I have found new purpose in my life since joining the team. And John Powell just organized, we're the first franchise to be a part of this Wizard World Ghostbuster Fan Fest leading up to the 35th anniversary. He got us a booth at Wizard World in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which at the time of this recording was this past weekend. John, you're a good guy, man. We all love you, and thank you for so much you bring to the team. He and I are in the equipment department. He's got a 3D printer, so he's got a leg up on me. So, you know, I'm a lot slower, but I try and contribute as much as I can. Okay, he asked a question that I could not find an answer to, but I'm going to divert it in a different direction. If Viggo was a prince, who was the king? The quick answer is, I have no fucking idea. Not an idea at all. But I can give you the background on Viggo. Viggo lived from 1505 to 1610. He was 105 years old. And per Tobin's spirit guide, he's a class 4 possessor. His power has been elevated by the psychomagnetheric ectoplasm running under the streets, which actually is a scene that's going on right now, where they're going to down there to see if they can find that river of slime once again. I missed it when I was talking, but those heads on a pike, people talk about the first movie was a lot scarier than the first movie. And like overall tone, I agree with that. However, the heads on a pike scene, oh my God, as a kid, I would walk out of the room because I didn't want to see it. And in the theater, I remember spilling my popcorn with my grandfather when that scene happened. I reference this on a daily basis. That was real stupid. Winston. Ernie Hudson, by the way, another shout out to John Powell. We're doing Conapalooza at Kingsport in October. And we're trying to break the world record for most people dressed in Ghostbuster costumes. But John's actually going to be heading up the Q&A panel with Ernie Hudson himself, Mr. Winston Zeddemore. So that's just it's a cool thing for all of us, but especially for John. This question comes from Fat Tony. My biggest gripe with Part 2 is turning Louis Tully from mildly goofy to full-on cartoon silly. Your thoughts? All right, Tony. You're not wrong. But it's not entirely the fault of the film. He had an entire subplot, he being Lewis. Pronouns, pal. Of him sort of trying to become the fifth Ghostbuster, which I think should have been more of a prevalent story arc in this movie, because he's sorely underused. Probably not as much in the script, but just in the way that they edited things. But he has this whole through line of him trying to catch Slimer, and some of those scenes were put into the montage. You see him, you know, like flipping over the couch and all of that. But there's this great deleted scene where he has a trap and he's taken string and he's hung all these drumsticks, you know, like chicken legs, over it. And he's trying to lure Slimer into it. And it's unfortunate that that stuff didn't make it into the movie. I'm not necessarily sure that it would make him less goofy, but I think it would have made him, his goofiness mean more, if that makes any sense. This question comes from Josh Ebel, another big Ghostbusters fan. Were there elements from the real Ghostbusters that were added to Ghostbusters 2? The sexual innuendo was toned down a lot because they're catering to a younger audience. You know, the 86 series where you have those network episodes that are, you know, the first seasons still had an edge to them, but the syndicated episodes, like they actually push the boundaries pretty far, but still you're catering to children. I talked about this in the first episode of this podcast, but there's an entity called Q5. They were a Canadian board that ABC used to kind of decide whether or not their program was suitable for children, and they made a bunch of bullshit answers that, like, Janine's glasses were sharp and that frightened children. So they in a roundabout way, one has affected the other. So you've got this kind of this wheel of circumstances. You have Janine from the first movie. And, you know, her hair's she's redheaded, but it's a little darker. You know, she's got the round glasses. Well, then you have the cartoon. She's got the pointy, pointy glasses and the dark, or the red hair. Well, then you have her appearance as she is right now on screen, you know, the bob haircut, the bright red hair. So the red hair is a bring on from the first movie. But then on the cartoon, after this movie came out, they made her appearance look like it is here. You know, round glasses, red hair. So, yeah, there were things taken from the cartoon series. And by real quick, before I get back into these questions, I have to pinpoint this movie, among a couple of other movies, as being like the awakening of my sexuality. Annie Potts as Janine Melnitz in the first movie, nothing. I mean, like, limp as a noodle. However, I have to contribute for specifically this scene into why I have a thing for girls with glasses and red hair. Because it's, yeah, it's doing it for me. I need it right now. Like, half mast. We're 10 to midnight. I'm joking, by the way. All right, this question comes from Margaret Carter Bridges. How different would your life be if Ghostbusters had never existed? Well, it would be, in a lot of ways, non-existent. My two favorite things is Ghostbusters and Friday the 13th. I guess the simple answer would be I would just be a way bigger Friday the 13th fan. But Ghostbusters has infiltrated itself into every aspect of my life. I mean, it's verbiage I use on a daily basis. Going back to saying before about the Smoky Mountain Ghostbusters, I've been dressing up as a Ghostbuster for a decade, doing cons and stuff, and then I moved that into the aspect of doing charity and taking something I love and using it to benefit people. That's a cool aspect, and I can't underestimate, you know, what I have in my life, in as far as a happiness level. It's a day-to-day thing. Anybody that knows me and get me into a conversation about Ghostbusters, you better be prepared and have the time to spare. By the way, the gentleman you just saw right there next to the blonde lady, she's going to get slime shellacked on her in just a second when they get kind of into talking about what's going on. But that's Peter Mosen. Peter Mosen is highly regarded in the Ghosthead fandom. You know, there's Deadheads, you know, the Grateful Dead fans. Well, Ghostbuster fans affectionately call one another Ghostheads. There it is. She just got slimed. Well, the gentleman, who's the date of the woman that just got slimed, he's highly regarded as the original Ghostbusters fan. There's a documentary called Ghostheads. I recommend anybody check it out, and you will be able to learn a lot about why he's held in such high regard. But I mean, he was the first person to, like, you know, build a proton pack and go, and he did like supermarket openings and I think he actually at one point may have worked for Columbia Pictures and did, you know, like, we need somebody to dress up. Go check it out. Here we've got our Bobby Brown cameo. Bobby Brown at this time was, you know, just under like Michael Jackson levels of fame. Obviously, over the years, his good name has been tarnished a bit with his relationship with the late Whitney Houston, and his daughter passed away as well. The music, albeit for the soundtrack, very, very popular to me growing up, probably not as iconic as some of the music from the first movie. That Ray Parker Jr. song from the first one, you know, will be played long after I'm dead or anybody, you know, involved with the movie was. But the soundtrack, which was released by MCA Records on May 26, 1989, a couple of months before the movie came out, to get everybody hyped for it. There's the remix by Run DMC. Listen, I'm a rock guy, you know, heavy metal to my core, but I fucking love Run DMC, and the Run DMC version of Ghostbusters, maybe a bit locked in time, you know, not as timeless as its predecessor, but it's nice to shake things up every once in a while. I love the music video. They're wearing the jumpsuits, and you know, you've got Sigourney Weaver coming out of the car and all that. Very, very cool. But it had music from Oingo Boingo, James Taylor, Bobby Brown's got a couple of songs on there, Dougie Fresh, Elton John, and Glenn Frey of the Eagles, who unfortunately has passed away within, was it last year, year before? Oh, Lenny, Mayor Lenny, played by David Margulies. He's unfortunately not with us anymore. And he passed away on January 11th of 2016. He was 78. He hung in there. But, yeah, he had a pretty stellar career. But, you know, on his tombstone, now I'm not being specific or sincere here. What am I trying to say? I'm not being serious. But, you know, his tombstone, his acting tombstone, he was the mayor in Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2. A little known fact about him, well, more about the character of Mayor Lenny Ramis. Never specifically said in either of the movies, but he, that's a little reference to Harold, to give him a little bit of depth of field for his character, a little in joke. He was in Ace Ventura, which, you know, kids of my era, you know, you love that movie, back when Jim Carrey was not entirely insane. He was in The Sopranos, you know, a role, actually got to show his acting chops. Not that he doesn't get to show his acting chops in these movies, but his role's impactful, but much smaller. So you actually get to see him show his chops a little more. He's also in one of the biggest cinematic flops of all time, Ishtar, which up until, you know, Battlefield Earth and more recently Justice League and all that, you know, one of the biggest flops of all time. John Carter, another one of the biggest flops. The Ghostbusters are about to be committed to the mental asylum, which will bring us in time to a scene I will discuss that was in the theatrical cut but has never been made available in any home video format. This gentleman right here, he may look a little familiar to you, standing to the right of Kurt Fuller's character Jack Hardemeyer, and that is Brian Doyle Murray, the brother of Bill, playing the psychiatrist. Obviously, he was in Caddyshack. He was the caddy master in that. Christmas Vacation, 16 Candles, Scrooge with his brother, JFK, Wayne's World, Groundhog Day with his brother. And we're talking about how David Margulies was the mayor in the first two movies. Well, we have the 2009 video game, and we've got, you know, him, Brian Doyle Murray, taking over the reins as the mayor of New York City, who becomes possessed at one point, leading you to believe that Mayor Lenny's bid for governor was probably successful. Way earlier in the joke, in the movie, when Peter first meets Jack, he has this great line where he's like, you know, almost 50% of us voted for him in the last election, which if you break that numbers down, four members, almost 50%. One of them. I wonder which one. They don't specify, but it's just a funny thing to think about. But yeah, Brian Doyle Murray, greatly overshadowed by his brother, but he works constantly, always doing TV shows and things like that. I didn't forgot to mention this earlier, but there was a part where Peter. When, you know, Dana and Peter, when Dana and Oscar rather are staying in Peter's apartment, and I didn't know this until I was doing research pretty recently for this episode. But Peter says something along the lines to Oscar, is like, "Hey, I've got some Laurie Antonelli tapes if you want to watch them." And I didn't have a clue who Laurie Antonelli was, and now that I've done my research, I know. I made the point about the the movie having been, some of the innuendo being turned down from the first movie because of the cartoon. Well, they snuck this one in, knowing that kids would have no idea who Laurie Antonelli was. Well, just to fill you in, Laurie Antonelli was a 1970s softcore porn actress. So I had a good kick about that. Oh, by the way, there was a high C in the background in the shot before Dana goes in to check on Oscar. Obviously, the high C Ecto Cooler, very, very popular when I was a kid. It made a comeback in 2016. I've got some cans of it, actually, in my room back here in the Black Lodge. If you can't track any down and you want to drink it, I believe it's called something orange or tangerine. God, now I'm blanking on it. But you can find it pretty easily. It's in an orange box. It's got an orange on the cover. So if you want to taste Ecto Cooler but don't want to pay a fuck ton to buy it off the secondary market, well, that's what you got to do. I actually got a really good recipe for Ecto Cooler ice cream. You know, you take heavy whipping cream, you beat it real good into a thicker base. You put in Ecto Cooler and put it in the freezer. I mean, there's a little more to it than that, but that's green food coloring. But it's actually pretty good. It's got a nice citrusy taste. It's more of a sorbet, but like a sherbet kind of a consistency than like creamy ice cream. But, you know, if you want to make some for a party, it's pretty easy to make. You can make it under $10. I also forgot to mention this earlier. When they were in the subway, Dennis Muren's team in ILM had made this giant frog creature. And I don't know why it didn't end up in the movie, whether just they ran out of time or who knows, but it didn't end up in the movie. However, there's a great book called Ghostbusters, a visual guide or a visual history, one or the other, and it breaks down the movies and all the supplementary materials, and there's a lot of concept art, and the thing was actually built, so I don't know why it wasn't filmed, or if it was, you know, why it didn't appear in the movie. But that's kind of sad, because if you get a chance to check it out, the exterior right here to the museum is actually the Alexander Hamilton U.S. Customs House. Movie magic, you know, you don't always have a location. You repurpose the exterior for things and the interior. Most of the things of this movie exterior were shot in New York. A lot of the interior stuff was shot, you know, in Los Angeles. Like all the outside shots of the firehouse, that's Hook and Ladder 8 in New York. However, it's another firehouse in Los Angeles for the interior, which kind of breaks my heart when I found that out initially, because it's like you go into Hook and Ladder number 8 and it's like, well, it looks right on the outside, but it's not right on the inside. I've often thought, if, you know, I won the big lottery, like, how much money would it cost to build my own firehouse or buy Hook and Ladder number 8 and have them remodel the inside? Which some people would say is a travesty because it's a historical landmark. And I'm like, how dare you change it to fit your nerdy needs? The character of Viggo, on top of the things I've said before, he has quite the fandom. In doing research for this episode, I found out there's a German doom metal band called Lord Viggo. They've got an EP and a couple of albums, but you know their whole shtick is rooted in the character of Viggo from this movie. They actually have a song called Viggo von Homburg Duschendorf. Pretty good. I was when I first kind of came across them, before I listened to the songs, I'm thinking like, oh God, this is going to be awful. Because, you know, a lot of these goofy bands, I'm thinking like Austrian Death Machine or something, like, yeah, this is going to be fun for like a listen, but I wouldn't want to listen to it multiple times. And I have to say, they're actually pretty good. I mean, if you're a metal fan. I know there's so many subgenres that maybe this is not your kitch. And there's a lot of people that just don't like metal at all. But they had an EP in 2015 called Under the Carpathian Sun, and they've got a couple albums, Blackborn Souls and Six Must Die. By the way, the on the marquee was Cannibal Girls. That was a movie that Eugene Levy made with Ivan Reitman in like 71 or 72. I think it was Ivan Reitman's first movie. Oh, this scene right here with the mink coat was actually written for the first movie, but for whatever reason, they just never got around to shooting it. When the Ghostbusters got out of the insane asylum being held, there was a scene in the original cut, speaking of Eugene Levy, that had him playing Lewis Tully's cousin named Sherman Tully, or Sherm. And he shows up and, you know, has his little comedic moment and, you know, gets him out. And it really, I guess, doesn't amount to a lot, but who doesn't want to see Eugene Levy in a movie? He's one of the greatest comedic actors of all time. There's Cheech Marin, speaking of great great creative comedic actors. Better late than never. That line, there are some versions of the trailer where Peter speaks that line, so it makes me wonder if that was... I know sometimes they'll shoot things for trailers specifically, and change it in the movie, so you're expecting something, you get something different. By the way, Ben Stein, why is he in the background? Who knows? They paid him a check. I used to love that show, Win Ben Stein's Money. It was a cool show. All right, let's see. We got any more questions? I don't know. I'm at a loss. All my notes are scrambled. Here we go. All right, this is from Fat Tony as well. If they got sued so bad because of the damage to the apartment building in the first movie, what do you think the repercussions of uprooting the Statue of Liberty would be? And that's going to be coming up, their solution to how they're going to get into the museum. I think you have to look at it from this perspective. They're barred from using their equipment up until the judge, Wexler, lifts that restraint on them. Their business got closed down. I think it was like, okay, you did this. We're not going to pay you, but you can't do this anymore. So I don't really think it was necessarily like, okay, you owe us a bunch of fucking money for blowing this up. As far as putting what the repercussions would be for uprooting the Statue of Liberty, well, if you notice at the end of the movie, it's back there. So I have to imagine that all was well. But when you look at it, like, the Statue of Liberty is up on this huge pillar. It's not like standing on, like, the bottom of Ellis Island. So how did it get down to begin with? By the way, we just passed a scene where it would have been Sherman Tully getting them out. But it brings us to another alternate version. And this, you can find these scenes on the Blu-ray. But originally, Jack Hartemeyer was going to meet his bitter end confronting the Ghostbusters here. He was going to go up to the slime covering the museum, and he was going to fall into it, and all that was going to be left of him was his shoes. And I guess that got vetoed as being too dark. I liked the sort of gallows humor in it, you know, the cruel clown kind of moment. But he survives, you know, at the end. He's singing, you know, with everybody at the end of the movie. So, I guess you could probably break down his being an asshole to being just the environment of all the negativity in the air affected him. I'm a little more of an asshole and would like him to get his bitter end a little more justly, but, you know, it is what it is. All right, our next question. come, you know, another one from John Powell. Do you think adding Eugene Levy's character could have added anything to the plot? Well, I just covered that briefly, but I don't think any movie could, any comedy would have been made better by Eugene Levy having anything to do with it. One of the greatest improvers of all time. Anybody that's seen his work with, especially with Christopher Guest, you know, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, he's so talented. He's another guy that works so often that, like a Christopher Walken, where like the quality of the movies he's in isn't always terrific, but his performance is always going to be terrific. So there's that. All right. This is from Sam Witt. Was there a reason why the jumpsuits in Ecto-1 were changed from Ghostbusters 1? Well, in the animated series, the four Ghostbusters have different color uniforms. And they actually, you know, most of the time in cartoons, especially during that time, didn't really explain away a lot of that stuff. But they made an effort to do this. I believe it's in the first season, where you have the debut of the People Busters, or the evil versions of the Ghostbusters. After the events of the first movie, you know, they're all wearing their tan jumpsuits or the khaki, and they go, and Egon tells Peter, "We got to destroy these because there's a dangerously high level of ectoplasmic containment or contamination to them, so they need to be destroyed." Well, there was a tiny leak in the containment unit, and they filled up with, you know, the spectral energy, and they formed ghostly versions of their counterparts. Well, in that, Janine says, "Okay, your other uniforms have arrived," and that's why they end up with different color uniforms. Really, it's a merchandising thing. It's to make them more easily recognizable. You have four guys standing there, three of which are white and, you know, dark haired. It kind of makes them not as discernible from each other. But then you have the cartoon, you know, Ray's chubby. He's got, you know, reddish hair. Peter's tall and skinny. Egon's blonde. He has a fucking rat tail. Bright red glasses. Just cosmetic changes to make everybody stand out a little more. As a kid, I still do, but I loved the real Ghostbusters so much, but I hated the way Egon looked so much that as much of the figures I had, he was always last on the list. Because I hated that he did not look like Harold Ramis. It just bothered. It still bothers me in some ways, but I've grown affectionate of the cartoon series over the years. By the way, we missed it, but it's really cool that they're controlling the Statue of Liberty. Right, there it is. Ray has it with the NES Advantage, or a modified NES Advantage. Anybody that was my age in the late 80s and early 90s, I mean, Nintendo was the fucking shit. I mean, Nintendo continues to make quality games and systems. There may be, they don't show you, but that's a step that really, that step down is, would have fucking broke the Statue of Liberty. But Nintendo was on top of the world, and maybe the perception now is that it's for kids and stuff, but that's all there was there then. You know, the Sega Master System, or the Genesis, whatever you want to call it, came out around the same time, but Atari had died out, and Nintendo was king. There was nobody even close. This movie was, well, both the movies are super popular all around the world. There's a you know, when they send these movies to other countries, most of the time, especially then, they were dubbed with other, you know, actors in their language. It's really only become in maybe the past 10 years that where subtitle movies are more commonplace. But in Germany, they dubbed the movie not only with German actors, but they changed the name of Oscar to Donald, because that sounds right. Oscar is sort of the character, sort of an interesting story in of itself. Oscar, played by a couple of twins, Will and Hank Duschendorf. Well, unfortunately, Hank is no longer with us. You know, he passed away June 14th, 2017. He was 29, I believe. He took his own life, and he had been struggling with mental issues most of his life. Now, both he and his brother were both black belts in martial arts, and you know, they were both disciplined, but it just, the demons just got to him at the end. There's a really great charity called Hank's Hope for a Cure. Our Ghostbuster group, we've all donated to it, and we try and spotlight it and raise money for it. But it's a real sensitive subject about, you know, suicide and things. So I would recommend, I mean, if you're going through stuff, you need help, you know, there's suicide prevention hotlines out there. You know, if you've got neurological issues, you know, don't take them lightly. Nobody wants you to be gone. There are people out there that care, and if you reach out, you know, you're going to find somebody willing to listen. This is Ghostbusters 2 is their one and done film credit. And that's kind of rare. You know, these people get their kids into acting, and you know, they kind of ride that gravy train. I have no idea what they made in the movie, but I'm sure that money's long gone. I don't know if they get any residuals or anything. But they were sort of born into the business. They're nephews of a guy by the name of John Duschendorf. Now, most people wouldn't know him by that name. His family does, or did, rather. But he's better known to the world as the singer of Sunshine on My Shoulder, John Denver. So that's another weird turnaround connection to the franchise. And we're approaching the climax of this movie, which I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of. I love this movie, and I will defend it most of the time. But I have to say, I think this movie is left a little to be desired at the end, because you have a more formidable villain, in the sense that Viggo, the tension has been building from him from the beginning, but then he shocks him with lightning, and they spray him. Well, Ray gets possessed for half a second, but I don't know. I just think they could have done a little more. Maybe had him manipulating his environment, throwing stuff at them. I mean, look at this. He's super intimidating as he comes out of the painting. Yeah, it's always Ray's duty to tell the big baddie to get back where they once belonged. Doesn't always quite work out that way. I mean, Viggo's pretty pretty handy in, you know, throwing it back in their face when all said and done. But he just ultimately it doesn't go to where go anywhere. Here they are, they're frozen. And I mean, like, I don't know. Like, as much special effects there are in this movie, you would have thought that, like, they could have kept the paralyzing effect on them, like, the visual effect on them longer. Diamond Select has been releasing all these great action figures from the first two movies, and now they're going into real Ghostbusters over the past few years. And they're getting ready to close up shop on their Ghostbusters 2 set. A few years ago, Mattel released a Vigo figure, but it didn't have the likeness rights. They made sort of a close enough kind of figure. However, this figure from Diamond Select is terrific. I mean, it really, really captures the Vigo von Homburg look, and that snarl, and he just looks like an asshole, and just, I mean, just got a big baddie. But the cool thing is, there's also a baby Oscar, and he has an interchangeable set of hands where he can hold Oscar in this very pose right there. And now you hear the cheering of the people, and it weakens Vigo. Those snarls, very terror dog-esque. You know, I didn't point this out earlier, but now that I'm noticing it, in the first movie, the tan jumpsuits had yellow relief hoses. Well, in the second movie, they're clear. I'm sure that's just someone either not paying attention or maybe it was an aesthetic choice. Either way, it's not important. But the charcoal gray suits don't have a relief hose on them at all. There's interesting theories as to what the purposes the relief hoses have. And this is my hypothesis between the tan jumpsuits and the charcoal gray ones. So they're flight suits, you know, worn by the Air Force, you know, fighter pilots, that kind of stuff, and they get up in the air and they're flying around. And what happens? You know, you had a drink before you got up there and you got a piss. Well, you can't just like pull over at a gas station. You gotta go. So you've got that hose and you relieve yourself into it. That's why it's called a relief hose. Well, the charcoal gray suits don't have the hose. And my hypothesis as to why is that, like, well, if you piss yourself, it's not going to show up. You know, it's gray. But the idea that the ghostbusting suits would have relief hoses on it is fucking hilarious, because it's like, okay, we're there to do something about your ghost, but we also might get so scared that we might piss ourselves. I have never personally been scared enough to piss myself, but I know it happens. Oh, this is a cool effect. Whoop! And it's all gone. Lewis gets his moment to feel like he's solved the problem. I love the shot of the Statue of Liberty just, you know, laying face down on the ground. You know, the slime has a base of this component called methicellulose, I believe I'm saying it correctly. It's an element they put in food. It's like a thickener. But you take that and some other handy dandy things and you can make it to different consistencies. This consistency right here it's more of a clear snot kind of it's gross. But you know, here on Janos, you know, it's a little more thick and pink. The slime in the first movie, it photographs as clear. It's actually supposed to be more of a greenish color. In the Now comic book, from like the first issue to the second issue, the slime completely changes colors. I don't know why I'm thinking of that right now. We were wrapping up, and God, I've laid the groundwork for a book's worth of knowledge. So I mean, what else is there to say? This movie has had a huge impact on my life. A real quick story. That painting right there, for my 30th birthday, Fat Fuck Scott and his wife, Bree, they actually got me a cake with that design on there. So that's a lovely gesture. And, I mean, I love cake to begin with, but you decorate it with Ghostbusters, I'm going to eat that shit up. So it's been a year. I don't even know what to say. When I started this podcast, you know, I'm pretty stubborn and bullheaded, but I really didn't know what the reception was going to be. I didn't know how and where I would be in a year, and here we are, you know, almost on the dot of a year, and I've had so many ups and downs. The second episode, you know, G.I. Joe almost made me want to quit. You guys voted for that, but ugh, it's just a terrible, terrible movie. And it's not that I'm immune to, there's Jack Heimer, Kurt Fuller, see, he's still alive. But I think things really, really clicked when Eddie came aboard. So I want to thank everybody that's been associated with the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast, in all sincerity. Judd Kelly, Eddie Shepard, Scott Huff, Cameron Allen. He just headed for the West, man. He's heading out to Seattle. My boy's getting old, but I'm very appreciative for everybody that's been supportive of the podcast, lent their viewpoint, and Robin Shelby, thank you so much for your contribution to this episode. Adam Marcus, for lending your credibility to our Jason Goes to Hell episode. Upcoming, you know, we've got some other people in the pipeline. Let's raise our glasses and hope for another year of podcasts. Thank you so much. As always, you can follow us at Rats Black Lodge on Twitter. You can find us on our homepage at juicykruger.com. We're available on multiple platforms. If you don't want to go to Juicy Kruger, say you use Spotify or Podbean, well, we're available there. iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, Google Play Music, just about anywhere that podcasts are available, one way or another, you can find us. We're out there. Well, for nobody else but me, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And we'll be back next month with another episode of the Rants from Black Lodge podcast. See you next time. And thanks again for a year worth of awesomeness.